Disc 5.
Chapter 53. Schaefer parked his Jag on the shadowy street and felt strangely alone and afraid. He was actually scaring himself, the things he thought and did. No one had a twisted mind like his. No one thought like this. No one had ever had such outlandish fantasies and ideas, and then acted them out. The other players also had complicated and very sick fantasy lives, of course, but they paled in comparison to his. Famine claimed authorship of a series of psychosexual murders in Thailand and the Philippines. War liked to think of himself as the uncrowned head of the group. He claimed to influence the adventures of the others. Conqueror was confined to a wheelchair and made up stories about using his infirmity to lure his prey close enough for the kill. Schaefer doubted that any of them actually had the guts to play the game out in the real world. But perhaps they would surprise him. Maybe each of the others was living out a homicidal fantasy. Wouldn't that be something? The Cahill women thought they were so perfectly safe inside the ranch house, less than 50 yards away. He could see a green wooden fence surrounding a stone terrace and lap swimming pool in the back. The house had sliding doors to the pool area. So many possibilities for him to consider. He might enter the house and murder both of them execution style. Then he would drive directly back to Washington. The local police and FBI would be totally baffled. The story might even make network TV. Two women shot and murdered while they slept, a mother and daughter whom everybody in their small town admired. No motive for the horrific crime. No suspects. He was hard now, and it was difficult to walk. That was comical to Schaefer, his absurd hard-on waddle. His mouth formed a smile. A dog was howling 2 or 3 houses down the street. A small wimpy dog from the sound of it. Then a larger dog joined in. They sensed death, didn't they? They knew he was here. Schaefer knelt beside a maple tree at the edge of the backyard. He stood in shadows while the moon cast a soft white light across the yard. He slid the 20-sided dice out of his pocket, then let them fall on the tufts of grass. Here we go, playing by the rules. Let's see what the night has to offer. He counted the numerals on the special dice. They appeared fuzzy in the dark. Schaefer couldn't believe what he saw. He wanted to howl like the crazed and bewildered neighborhood dogs. The dice count was 5. Death had to leave. This instant, there could be no murders tonight. No, he wouldn't do it. To hell with the dice. He wouldn't leave. He couldn't. He was losing all impulse control, wasn't he? Well, so be it. Alea iacta est, he remembered from his schoolboy Latin classes. Julius Caesar before he crossed the Rubicon. The die is cast. This was a monumental night. For the first time he was breaking the rules. He was changing the game forever. He needed to kill someone, and the urge was everything to him. He hurried to the house before he changed his mind. He was nervous. Adrenaline punched through his system. He used his glass cutter at first, but then just smashed in a small window with a gloved hand. Once inside, he moved quickly down the darkened hallway. He was sweating, so unlike him. He entered Deirdre's bedroom. She was asleep, despite the breaking of the glass. Her bare arms were thrown up over her head, the surrender position. Lovely, he whispered. She was wearing white bikini panties and a matching bra. Her long legs were spread delicately, expectantly. In her dreams, she must have known he was coming. Schaefer believed that dreams told you the truth, and you had better listen. He was still hard, and so glad he'd chosen to disobey the rules. "Who the hell are you?" he heard suddenly. The voice came from behind. Schaefer whirled around. It was Lindsay, the daughter. She wore nothing but coral pink underwear, a brassiere, and briefs. He calmly raised his gun until it pointed between her eyes. "Shh. You don't want to know, Lindsay," he said in the calmest voice, not bothering to disguise his English accent. "But I'll tell you anyway." He fired the gun. Chapter 54. For the second time in my life, I understood what it felt like to be a victim of a terrible crime, rather than the detective investigating it. I was disconnected and out of it. I needed to be doing something positive on a case, or get back to volunteer work at St. Anthony's. Anything to take my mind off what had happened. I had to be busy, but I knew I'd lost my ability to concentrate, something that had always come so naturally to me. I came across a pair of shocking murders in Virginia that bothered me for some unspecified reason. I didn't follow up on them. I should have. I wasn't myself. I was lost. I still spent endless hours thinking about Christine, remembering everything about our time together, seeing her face wherever I went. Samson tried to push me. He did push me. He and I made the rounds of the streets of Southeast. We put the word out that we were looking for a purple and blue cab, possibly a gypsy. We canvassed door-to-door in the Shaw neighborhood where Tory Glover and Marion Cardinal had been found. Often we were still going at 10 or 11 at night. I didn't care. I couldn't sleep anyway. Samson cared. He was my friend. You're supposed to be working the Odenkirk case, right? I'm not supposed to be working at all. The jefe will be livid. I kind of like that, Samson said as we trudged along S Street late one evening. Samson had lived in this neighborhood for years. He knew all the local hangarounds. Jamal, you know anything I should know? He called out to a goateed youth sitting in shadows on a graystone stoop.
Don't know nothing. Just relaxing my mind, catching a cool night breeze. How about yourself?
Samson turned back to me. Damn crack runners running these streets everywhere you look nowadays. Real good place to commit a murder and never get caught. You talked to the police in Bermuda lately? I nodded, and my eyes stared at a fixed point up ahead. Patrick Busby said the story of Christine's disappearance is off the front pages. I don't know if that's good or bad. It's probably bad. Samson agreed. Takes the pressure off them. You going back down there? Not right away. But yeah, I have to go back. I have to find out what happened. He looked me in the eye. Are you with me here right now? Are you here, sugar? Yeah, I'm here. Most of the time. I'm functioning okay. I pointed up at a nearby red brick building. That place would have a view of the front entryway into the girls' building. Any of those windows. Let's get back to work. Samson nodded. I'm here as long as you want to be. There was something about pounding the streets that appealed to me that night. We talked to everyone in the building that we could find at home, about half the apartments. Nobody had seen a purple and blue cab on the street. Nobody had seen Tori or Marion either. Or so they said. You see any connections anywhere? I asked as we came down the steep stairs of a fourth-floor walk-up. What do you see? What the hell am I missing?
Not a thing, Alex. Nothing to miss.
Weasel didn't leave a clue. Never does.
We got back down to the entrance and met up with an elderly man carrying 3 clear plastic bags of groceries from the Stop and Shop. We're homicide detectives, I said to him. 2 young girls were murdered across the street. The man nodded.
Tori and Marion. I know 'em. You want to know about that fellow watching the building? He was sitting there most of the night. Inside a slick, fancy black car, he said. Mercedes, I think. You think maybe he's the killer?
Chapter 55.
I've been away a while, you see. Visiting with my 2 old bat sisters in North Carolina for a week of good memories. Home-cooked food,
the elderly man said as we went up to the fourth floor.
That was why I was missed during the earlier time through here by your detectives.
This was old-school police work, I was thinking as I climbed stairs. The kind of work too many detectives try to avoid. The man's name was DeWitt Luke, and he was retired from Bell Atlantic, the huge phone company that services most of the Northeast. He was the 53rd interview I'd had so far in Shaw.
Saw him sitting there around 1 in the morning. Didn't think much of it at first. Probably waiting for somebody. Seemed to be minding his own business. He was still there at 2, though. Sitting in his car. Seemed kind of strange to me.
He paused for a long moment as if trying to remember. Then what happened? I prompted the man.
Fell asleep. But I got up to pee around 3:30. He was still in that shiny black car, so I watched him closer this time. He was watching the other side of the street, like some kind of damn spy or something. Couldn't tell what he was looking at, but he was studying something real hard over there. I thought it might be the police, except his car was too nice.
You got that right, Samson said, and barked out a laugh. No Mercedes in my garage.
I pulled up a card table chair behind the darkened window in my apartment. Made sure there were no lights on, so he couldn't see me. By now, he'd caught my attention some. Remember the old movie, Rear Window? I tried to figure out why he might be down there sitting, waiting. Jealous lover, jealous husband, maybe some kind of night stalker. But he wasn't bothering anybody far as I could see.
I spoke again. You never got a better look than that, man sitting in the car.
Around the time I got up to pee, he got out of the car, opened the door, but the inside light didn't come on. That struck me strange, it being such a nice car and all. Fueled my mind even more. I squinted my eyes, get a better look.
Another long pause. And?
He was tall, a blonde gentleman, white fella. We don't get too many of them around here at night, or even in the daytime, for that matter.
Chapter 56. Detective Patsy Hampton's investigation of the Jane Doe murders was starting to show forward movement and positive results. She thought she might have something good in the works. She had confidence in her ability to solve the murders. She knew from experience that she was smarter than everybody else. It helped to have Chief Pittman and all the department's resources on her side. She had spent the past day and a half with Chuck Hofstetler at the FBI building. She knew she was using Chuck a little, but he didn't seem to mind. He was lonely, and she did like his company. She and Chuck were still sitting around at 3:30 in the afternoon when Lancelot entered the Gamester's chat room again. Laugh-a-lot, she remembered.
He couldn't resist, could he? Hampton said to Hofstetler.
Gotcha, you fantasy freak. Hofstetler looked at her, his thick black eyebrows arched.
3:30 in the afternoon, Patsy. What does that say?
Tell you what it says to me.
Maybe he's playing from work, but I bet our Lancelot is a school kid.
Or he's somebody who likes to play with school kids. She offered a thought that upset her even as she uttered the words. This time she didn't try to make contact with Lancelot. She and Chuck just listened in on a stultifying discussion of several role-playing games. In the meantime, he was trying to trace Lancelot.
He's pretty good at this, a real hacker. He's built a lot of security into his system. Hopefully, we'll get to him anyway.
I have confidence in you, Cheese Man.
Lancelot stayed in the chat room past 4:30. By then, it was all over. Chuck had his name and address. Michael Ormson, Hutchins Place, Foxhall. At a few minutes before 5, two dark blue vans pulled up in front of the Ormson house on the Georgetown Reservoir. 5 agents in blue FBI windbreakers and Detective Patsy Hampton surrounded the large Tudor-style house with an acre or two of front and back lawn and majestic views. Senior FBI agent Bridget Dwyer and Hampton proceeded to the front door and found it unlocked. With weapons drawn, they quietly entered the house and discovered Lancelot in the den. He looked to be around 13 years old, a baby geek. He was sitting at a computer in his shorts and black socks.
Hey, what the heck is going on? Hey, what are you doing in my house? I didn't do anything wrong. Who are you guys?
Michael Ormson asked in a high-pitched, peeved but quivering voice. He was skinny. His face was covered with acne. His back and shoulders had a rash that looked like eczema. Chuck Hofstetler had been right on target. Lancelot was a teenage geek playing with his fancy computer after school. He wasn't the weasel, though. This boy couldn't be the weasel.
Are you Michael Ormson?
Patsy Hampton asked the boy. She had lowered her weapon, but hadn't holstered it. The young boy dropped his head and looked ready to weep.
Oh, God. Oh, God.
He moaned.
Yes, I'm Michael Ormson. Who are you guys? Are you going to tell my parents?
Chapter 57. Michael's father and mother were immediately contacted at their jobs at Georgetown University Hospital and the U.S. Naval Observatory, respectively. The Ormsons were currently separated, but they both made it to Foxhall in less than 10 minutes, even with rush hour traffic starting to build. The other two Ormson children, Laura and Anne Marie, had already come home from high school. Patsy Hampton convinced the parents to let her talk to their son at the house. She told the Ormsons that they could be present and could interrupt and even stop the interview any time they wished. Otherwise, she and Agent Dwyer would have to take Michael to FBI headquarters for the interview. The Ormsons, Mark and Cindy, agreed to let Michael talk. They were clearly frightened, especially of the FBI personnel, but they seemed to trust Detective Hampton. Most people did, she knew. She was pretty and sincere, and had a disarming smile that she used when she needed to. "I'm interested in the game called the Four Horsemen," Hampton said to the boy. "That's the only reason I'm here, Michael. I need your help." The teenager dropped his chin to his chest again, and then shook his head back and forth. Hampton watched the nervous boy, and decided to take a chance with him. She had a hunch that she wanted to play.
"Michael, whatever you think you've done wrong, it's nothing to us. It's nothing. We don't care what you've done on your computer. This isn't about you, or your family, or your hacking. There have been some terrible murders in Washington, and there might be a connection to this game called the Four Horsemen. Please help us, Michael. You're the only one who can. You're the only one."
Mark Ormson, who was a radiologist at Georgetown University Hospital, leaned forward on the black leather couch in the den. He looked more frightened now than when he'd gotten home.
"I'm beginning to think I better get a lawyer," he said.
Patsy Hampton shook her head and smiled kindly at both parents.
"This is not about your son, Mr. and Mrs. Ormson. He's not in any trouble with us, I assure you."
She turned back to the teenager.
"Michael, what do you know about the Four Horsemen? We know you're not one of the players. We know it's a very private game."
The boy looked up. She could tell that he liked her, and maybe trusted her some.
"Hardly anything, ma'am. I don't know too much."
Hampton nodded.
"This is very important to us, Michael. Someone is killing people in the southeast part of Washington. For real, Michael. This is not a fantasy game. I think you can help us. You can save others from getting murdered."
Michael dropped his head again. He had hardly looked at his mother and father since they arrived.
"I'm good with computers. You probably already figured that out."
Detective Hampton kept nodding, giving the boy positive reinforcement.
"We know you are, Michael. We had trouble tracing you here. You're very good with computers.
My friend Chuck Hufstedler at the FBI was really impressed. When all this is over, you can see where he works. You'll like him, and you'll love his equipment." Michael smiled, showing off large protruding teeth with braces.
"Back at the beginning of summer, probably late in June, this guy came into the Gamester's chat room, where you found me."
Patsy Hampton tried to hold eye contact with the boy. She needed him badly. She had a feeling that this was a big break, her biggest so far. Michael continued to speak softly.
"He sort of, like, he took over the conversation. Actually, he was pretty much a control freak about it. He kept putting down Highlander, D&D, Millennium, all the hot games that are out now. Wouldn't let anybody else get a word in. Almost seemed like he was high on something. He kept hinting about this completely different game he played called the Four Horsemen. It was like he didn't want to tell us about it, but then he would give out bits and pieces anyway. But not much. He wouldn't shut up. He said the characters in Dungeons & Dragons, Dune, and Condottiere were predictable and boring, which I must admit they are sometimes. Then he said some of the characters in his game were chaotic evil instead of lawful good. He said they weren't fake heroes like in most RPGs. His characters were more like people in real life. They were basically selfish, didn't really care about others, didn't follow society's rules. He said Horseman was the ultimate fantasy game. That was all he would tell us about the Four Horsemen, but it was enough.
I mean, you could see it was a game for total psychos.
What was his call name? Agent Dwyer asked Michael.
Call name? Or his real name?
Michael asked, and offered up a sly, superior smile. Agent Dwyer and Hampton looked at each other. Call name or his real name? They turned back to Michael.
I traced him, just like you traced me. I got through his encryptions. I know his name and I know where he lives, even where he works. It's Schaefer, Jeffrey Schaefer. He works at the British Embassy on Massachusetts Avenue. He's some kind of information analyst there, according to the embassy's website. He's 44 years old.
Michael Ormson looked sheepishly around the room. He made eye contact with his parents, who finally looked relieved. Then he looked back at Hampton.
Is any of that stuff helpful to you? Did I help?
Yes, you did. Laugh a lot. Chapter 58.
Jeffrey Schaefer had vowed he would not get high on pharmaceuticals tonight. He'd also decided he was going to keep his fantasies under control, under wraps. He understood precisely what the psychobabbling profilers on the murder cases would be thinking. His fantasy life was escalating, and he was approaching a rage state. And the profilers would be exactly right, which was why he was playing it cool for a while. He was a skillful cook, skilled at a lot of things, actually. He sometimes put together elaborate meals for his family, and even large dinner parties with friends. When he cooked, he liked to have the family with him in the kitchen. He loved an audience, even his wife and kids.
"Tonight we'll be eating classic Thai," he announced to Lucy and the children as they watched him work. He was feeling a little hyper and reminded himself not to let things get out of hand at home. Maybe he ought to take some Valium before he began to cook. All he'd taken so far was a little Xanax.
What sets Thai food apart from other Southeast Asian cuisines are the explicit rules for proportions of ingredients, especially seasonings, he said, as he prepared a centerpiece of carved vegetables.
Thai is a distinctive cuisine, blending Chinese, Indonesian, Indian, Portuguese, Malaysian. Bet you didn't know that, Tricia and Erica.
The little girls laughed, confused, so much like their mother. He put jasmine blossoms in Lucy's hair, then a blossom each for the twins. He tried the same with Robert, but his son pulled away laughing.
"Nothing too hot tonight, darling," Lucy said. "The children?"
"The children, of course, dear.
Speaking of hot, the real heat comes from capsaicin, which is stored in the ribs of these chili peppers. Capsaicin is an irritant and burns whatever it touches, even skin, so it's wise to wear gloves. I'm not wearing gloves, of course, because I'm not wise. Also, I'm a little crazy."
He laughed. Everyone did. But Lucy looked worried. Schaefer served the dinner himself, without any help, and he announced the name of each dish both in Thai and in English.
"Pla mayuk yang, or roast squid. Delicious. Mieng kum, leaf rolls with treasures. Yummy. Pla yang kaeng fet, grilled snapper with red curry sauce. Delectable. A little hot, though,
He watched them tentatively sample each course, and as they tasted the snapper, tears began to run down their faces. Erica began to choke.
"Daddy, it's too hot," Robert complained, gulping.
Schaefer smiled and nodded blithely. He loved this, the flowing tears, his perfect little family in pain. He savored each exquisite moment of their suffering. He'd managed to turn the dinner into a tantalizing game after all.
At 8:45, he kissed Lucy and started off on his constitutional, as he called his nightly disappearing act. He went out to the Jag and drove a few blocks to Phelps' place, a quiet street without many lights. He took liberal doses of Thorazine and Librium, then injected himself with Toradol. He took another Xanax. Then he went to his doctor's. Chapter 59. Schaefer didn't like the arrogant asshole doorman at Boo Cassidy's building, and they didn't like him, he decided. Who needed their approval anyway?
They were shiftless, lazy incompetents, incapable of doing much more than holding open doors and offering up ingratiating smiles to fat cat tenants.
"I'm here to see Dr. Cassidy," Schaefer announced to the familiar black wanker with Mal jauntily pinned on his lapel.
It was probably there so he wouldn't forget his own name.
"Right," said Mal.
"Isn't that right, sir?"
"Right, sir. I'll ring up Dr. Cassidy. Wait right here, sir."
He could hear Boo through the doorman's staticky phone receiver. She had no doubt left explicit instructions that he be led up immediately. She certainly knew he was coming. They'd talked during the car ride from his house.
"You can go up now, sir," the doorman finally said.
"I'm fucking her brains out, Mal," Schaefer said. He waltzed to the elevators with a grin.
"You watch that door now. Don't let anyone take it."
Boo was in the hallway to meet him when the elevator cruised to a stop on 10. She was wearing at least $5,000 worth of clothes from Escada. She had a great body, but she looked like a bullfighter or a marching band leader in the gaudy outfit. No wonder her first two husbands had divorced her. The second husband had been a therapist and treating M.D. Still, she was a good, steady mistress who gave much better than she got. More important, she was able to get him Thorazine, Librium, Ativan, Xanax. Most of the drugs were samples from drug company representatives. Her husband had left them behind when they'd split. The number of samples left by the drug reps amazed Schaefer, but she assured him it was common practice. She had other friends who were doctors, and she hinted to Schaefer that they helped her out in return for an occasional fuck. She could get all the drugs he needed.
Schaefer wanted to take her right there in the hall,
and he knew Boo would like the spontaneity and the passion that were so clearly missing from her life. Not tonight, though. He had more basic needs, the drugs.
"You don't look too happy to see me, Jeff," she complained.
She took his face in her manicured hands. Christ, her long, varnished red nails scared him.
"What happened, darling? Something's happened. Tell Boo what it is."
Schaefer took her in his arms and held her tightly against his chest. She had large, soft breasts, great legs, too. He stroked her frosted blonde hair and nuzzled her with his chin. He loved the power he had over her, his goddamned shrink.
"I didn't want to talk about it just yet. I'm here with you. I feel much better already." "What happened, darling? What's wrong? You have to share these things with me."
So he made up a story on the spot, acted it out. Nothing to it.
"Lucy claims she knows about us. God, she was paranoid before I started to see you. Lucy always threatens to destroy my life. She says she'll leave me, sue for what fucking little I have. Her father will have me fired, then blackball me in the government and in the private sector, which he's perfectly capable of doing. The worst thing is, she's poisoning the children, turning them against me. They use the same belittling phrases that she does. Colossal failure. Underachiever. Get a real job, Daddy. Some days I wonder whether it isn't true."
Boo kissed him lightly on the forehead.
"No, no, darling. You're well thought of at the embassy. I know you're a loving dad. You just have a bitchy, mean-spirited, spoiled, rotten wife who gets you down on yourself. Don't let her do it."
He knew what she wanted to hear next, so he told her.
"Well, I won't have a bitchy wife for much longer. I swear to God I won't, Boo. I love you dearly, and I'm going to leave Lucy soon."
He looked at her heavily made-up face and watched as tears formed and ruined her look.
"I love you, Jeff," she whispered,
and Schaefer smiled as if he were pleased to hear it.
God, he was so good at this. Lies, fantasies, role-playing games.
He unbuttoned the front of her mauve silk blouse, fondled her, then carried her inside to the sofa.
"This is my idea of therapy," he whispered hotly into Boo's ear. "This is all the therapy I need."
Chapter 60. I had been up since before 5 that morning. I had to call Inspector Patrick Busby in Bermuda. I wanted to talk to him every day, sometimes more than once. But I stopped myself. It would only make things worse, strain my relations with the local police, and signal that I didn't trust them to handle the investigation properly. Patrick, it's Alex Cross calling from Washington. Did I catch you at a good time? Can you talk for a moment now? I asked. I always tried to sound as upbeat as possible. I wasn't, of course. I had been up pacing the house and already had breakfast with Nana. Then I'd waited impatiently until 8:30 to call Busby at the station house in Hamilton. He was an efficient man, and I knew he was there every morning by 8. I could picture the thin, wiry policeman as we talked on the phone. I could see the tidy cubicle office where he worked. And superimposed over everything, I could still see Christine on her moped waving goodbye to me on that perfectly sunny afternoon. "I have a few things for you from my contact at Interpol," I said. I told him about an abduction of a woman on Jamaica earlier in the summer, and another in Barbados. Both were similar, though not identical to Christine's disappearance. I didn't think they were connected, really, but I wanted to give him something, anything. Patrick Busby was a thoughtful and patient man. He remained silent until I had finished talking before asking his usual quota of logical questions. I had observed that he was flawed as an interrogator because he was so polite, but at least he hadn't given up.
"I assume that neither abduction was ever solved, Alex. How about the women who were taken? Were they found?"
"No. Neither woman was seen again. Not a sign of them. They're still missing." He sighed into the phone receiver.
"I hope your news is helpful in some way, Alex. I'll certainly call the other islands and check into it further. Anything else from Interpol or the FBI?
I wanted to keep him on the line. The lifeline, as I now thought of it. "A few far-flung possibilities in the Far East. Bangkok, the Philippines, Malaysia. Women abducted and murdered, all Jane Doe's. To be honest, nothing too promising at this point." I imagined him pursing his thin lips and nodding thoughtfully.
"I understand, Alex. Please keep giving me whatever you get from your sources. It's difficult for us to get help outside this small island. My calls for assistance frequently aren't returned. I sincerely wish that I had some good news for you on my end, but I'm afraid I don't. Other than Perry Graham, no one saw the man with the van.
No one seems to have seen Christine Johnson in Hamilton or St. George either.
It's truly a baffling mystery. I don't believe that she ever got to Hamilton. It's frustrating for us, too. My prayers are with you and your wonderful family, and, of course, John Sampson."
I thanked Patrick Busby and hung up the phone. I went upstairs and dressed for work. I still had nothing really substantial on the murder of Frank Odenkirk, and the jefe was contacting me daily on email. I certainly knew how the Odenkirk family felt. The media heat about the homicide had died down, though, as it often does. Unfortunately, so had the Post stories about the unsolved murders in Southeast. While I was taking a hot shower, I thought about DeWitt Luke and the mysterious Watcher on S Street. What was the man in the Mercedes doing out there for so long? Did he have some connection with the murders of Tory Glover and Marion Cardinal? None of this was making complete sense to me. That was the truly maddening thing about the Jane Doe murders and the Weasel. He wasn't like other repeat killers. He wasn't a criminal genius like Gary Sonogy, but he was effective. He gets the job done, doesn't he? I needed to think more about why someone had been lurking outside Tory Glover's apartment. Was he a private detective, a stalker, or was he actually the murderer? One possibility hit me. Maybe the man in the car was an accomplice of the killer. Two of them, working together? I'd seen that before in North Carolina. I turned up the water, made it hotter. I thought it would help me to concentrate better, steam out the cobwebs in my brain, bring me back from the dead. Nana began banging on the pipes from downstairs in the kitchen.
"Get down here and go to work, Alex. You're using up all my hot water," she yelled above the noise of the shower.
"Last time I looked, my name was on the water and gas bills," I shouted back.
"It's still my hot water. Always was. Always will be, Anna replied.
Chapter 61. Every day, every night, I was out on the streets of Southeast, working harder than ever, but with nothing much to show for it. I continued to search for the mysterious purple and blue cab, and for the late model black Mercedes that DeWitt Luke had seen on S Street. Sometimes I felt as if I were sleepwalking, but I kept at it, sleepwalking as fast as I could. Everything about the investigation seemed a long shot at best. I received tips and leads every day that had to be followed up. None of them went anywhere, though. I got home at a little past 7 that night, and tired as I was, I still let the kids drag me downstairs for their boxing lesson. Damon was showing me a lot of hand speed, and also some pretty good footwork and power for his age. He's always had good spirit, and I was confident that he wouldn't abuse his burgeoning boxing skills at school. Janny was more a student of boxing, though she seemed to recognize the value of being able to defend herself. She was quick at mastering techniques, seeing connections, even if her heart wasn't completely in the sport. She preferred to torture her brother and me with her taunts and wit.
"Alex, telephone," Nana called down from the top of the cellar stairs.
I looked at my watch, saw it was 7:40. "Practice your footwork," I told the kids. Then I trudged up the steep stone stairs. "Who is it?"
"Wouldn't say who it was," Nana said as I got up to the kitchen.
She was making shrimp and corn fritters, and the room was filled with the glorious smells of honey-baked apples and gingerbread. It was a late dinner for us. Nana had waited until I got home. I picked up the phone on the kitchen counter. "Alex Cross?"
"I know who you are, Detective Cross."
I recognized the voice immediately, though I'd heard it only once before, in the Belmont Hotel in Bermuda. A chill went right through me, and my hands shook.
"There's a payphone outside the Budget Drugs on 4th Street. She's safe for now. We have her. But hurry. Hurry. Maybe she's on the payphone right now. I'm serious. Hurry."
Chapter 62. I exploded at the back kitchen door without saying a word to Nana or the kids. I didn't have time to explain where I was going or why. Besides, I didn't really know exactly what was happening. Had I just spoken to the weasel? "Hurry. Maybe she's on the payphone right now. I'm serious." I sprinted across 5th Street, then down a side alley and over to 4th. I dashed another 4 blocks south toward the Anacostia River. People on the streets watched me running. I was like a tornado suddenly roaring through Southeast. I could see the metal frame of a payphone from more than a block away as I approached Budget Drugs. A young girl was leaning against the graffiti-covered wall of the drugstore, talking on the phone. I pulled up my detective shield as I raced the final block toward her. This particular phone gets a lot of use. Some people in the neighborhood don't have phones in their homes.
"Police! I'm a homicide detective. Get off the phone,"
I told the girl, who looked 19 or so. She stared at me as if she couldn't care less that a D.C. policeman was trying to commandeer the phone.
"I'm using this phone, mister. Don't care who you are. You can wait your turn like everybody else."
She turned away from me.
"Probably just calling your honey."
I yanked the receiver away from her, disconnected her call.
"The fuck you think you are?"
the girl shouted at me, her face screwed up in anger.
"I was talking. The fuck you thinking?"
"I'm thinking you better get out of my face. This is a life and death situation. Get away from this phone. Now! Get out of here!"
I could see she had no intention of leaving.
"There's been a kidnapping,"
I was yelling like a madman. She finally backed away. She was afraid that I was really crazy, and maybe I was. I stood there with the phone receiver in my hand, trembling, waiting for the call to come in. I was winded. Sweat covered my body. I stared up and down 4th Street. Nothing obvious or suspicious. I didn't see a purple and blue cab parked anywhere. No one watching me. Somebody definitely knew who I was. He had called me at the Belmont Hotel. He had called me at home. I could still hear the caller's voice echoing loudly inside my head. I'd been hearing that same deep, wretched voice for weeks. She's safe for now. We have her. Those were the words spoken to me 6 weeks before in Bermuda. I hadn't heard another word from the caller until now. My heart was pounding, sounding as if it were amplified in my ears. Adrenaline was rushing like powerful rivers through my bloodstream. I couldn't stand this. The caller had stressed that I hurry. A young man approached the payphone. He stared at my hand on the receiver.
What's up, man? I need to use the phone. The phone. You hear me?
Police business. I gave him a hard stare. Take a walk, please. Go!
Don't look like no police business to me, he mumbled.
The man moved away, looking over his shoulder as he retreated down Fourth, frowning, but not stopping to argue with me. The caller liked to be completely in control, I was thinking as I stood there helpless in front of the busy drugstore. He'd made me wait this long since the Bermuda call, possibly to demonstrate his power. Now he was doing it again. What did he really want, though? Why had he taken Christine? We have her, he'd said, and he'd repeated the very same words when he called my house. Was there really a we? What kind of group did he represent? What did they want? I stood at the payphone for 10 minutes, 15, 20. I felt as if I were going mad, but I would stay here all night if I had to. I began to wonder if this was the right phone, but I knew it was. He had been crystal clear, calm, in control. For the first time in weeks, I allowed myself to truly hope that Christine might be alive. I imagined her face, her deep brown eyes that showed so much love and warmth. Maybe, just maybe, I would be allowed to talk to her. I let my anger build toward the unknown caller, but then I cut it off, shut down my emotions, and waited with a cool head. People came and went, in and out of the drugstore. A few wanted to use the phone. They took one look at me, and they moved on in search of another phone. At 9:05, the phone rang. I lifted the receiver instantly. "This is Alex Cross," I said.
"Yes, I know who you are. That's already been established. Here's what you should do. Back all the way off. Just back away. Before you lose everything you care about. It can happen so easily, in a snap. You're smart enough to understand that, aren't you?"
Then the caller hung up. The line was dead. I banged the phone with the receiver. I cursed loudly. The manager from the drugstore had come outside and was staring at me.
"I'm going to call the police," he said. "That's a public phone."
I didn't bother to tell him I was the police. Chapter 63. Was it the weasel who had called? Was I dealing with one killer or more than one? If only I had some idea who the caller was and who he meant by we. The message scared me just as much as the first one had, maybe even more. But it also gave me hope that Christine might still be alive. With hope came a jolting surge of pain. If only they would put Christine on the phone. I needed to hear her voice.
What did they want?
Back all the way off. Back off from what? The Odenkirk murder case? The Jane Doe's? Perhaps even Christine's disappearance? Was Interpol or the FBI getting close to something that had scared them? We weren't close to anything that could solve any of the cases, and I knew timing was critical. Early Wednesday morning, Samson and I drove to Eckington. A woman over there knew where a purple and blue cab was garaged. We'd followed up a dozen or so leads like this already, but it didn't matter. Every lead had to be investigated. Every single one. "Cab owner's name is Arthur Marshall," I told Samson as we walked from my car toward a red brick garden apartment that had seen better days. "Trouble is, Arthur Marshall seems to be a false identity. Landlady has him working at a Target store. According to Target, he doesn't. Never worked at any Target store. Hasn't been seen around for a while, according to the landlady."
"Maybe we spooked him," Samson said.
"I hope not, but you may be right." I glanced around at the lower middle-class neighborhood as we walked. Overhead, the sky was a bright blue canvas, nearly empty of clouds. The street was packed with one- and two-story homes. Bright orange flyers were sticking out from the mailboxes. Every window was a possible lookout for the weasel. Back away, he had warned. I couldn't. Not after what he'd done. I knew I was taking a risk, though. He probably spotted us canvassing the streets. If he was responsible for the Jane Doe murders, he had been working undetected for a long while. He was skillful, good at killing, at not getting caught. The landlady told us what she knew about Arthur Marshall, which wasn't much more than the information she needed to rent him a one-bedroom apartment and the attached garage. She gave us a set of keys for the place and said we could go look for ourselves. The second house was similar to the landlady's, except that it was painted Easter egg blue. Samson and I entered the garage first. The purple and blue cab was there. Arthur Marshall had told the landlady that he owned the cab and operated it as a part-time job. That was a possibility, but it seemed unlikely. The weasel was close. I could feel it now. Had he known we would find the cab? Probably. Now what? What came next? What was his plan? His fantasy? I'm going to have to figure out how to get some techies in here, I told Samson. There has to be something in the cab, or maybe upstairs in the apartment. Hair, fibers, prints. Hopefully no damn body parts, Samson said, and grimaced. It was typical cop humor, and so automatic that I didn't give it a second thought. Body parts are always popping up in these cases, Alex. I don't want to see it. I like feet attached to ankles, heads attached to necks, even if all the parts happen to be dead. Samson searched around the front seat of the cab with latex-gloved hands. Papers in here. Candy and gum wrappers, too. Why not call in a favor from Kyle Craig? Get the FBI boys over here. Actually, I talked to Kyle last night, I said. The Bureau's been involved for some time. He'll help out if we say the word. Samson tossed me a pair of gloves, and I examined the cab's back seat. I saw what could be bloodstains in the fabric of the seat cushion. The stains would be easy enough to check out. John and I finally climbed upstairs into the apartment above the garage. It was dusty, grimy, without much furniture. Eerie and unpleasant on the eyes. It didn't look as if anyone lived there, but if someone did, he was really weird. The landlady had said as much. The kitchen was mostly empty. An expensive juicer was the only personal indulgence. Not a low-end model. Expensive. I took out my handkerchief and opened the refrigerator. There was nothing in it but bottled water and some aging fruit. The fruit was rotting, and I hated to think of what else we might find here in the apartment. Health nut, Samson offered. Nut, anyway, I said. There's a sense of animal fear in here. He gets very tense, excited, when he comes to this place. Yeah, Samson said. I know the feeling. We entered the bedroom, which was furnished with only a small cot, a couple of stuffed chairs, nothing else. There was a sense of fear here, too. I opened the closet door, and what I saw stopped me dead. There was a pair of khaki pants, a blue chambray shirt, a blue blazer, and something else. John, come here, I called. John! Oh, shit. Do I have to? Not more bodies. Just come here. It's him. This is the weasel's place, I'm sure of it. It's worse than a body. I opened the closet door wider and let Samson see what I'd found there. Shit, he groaned. God damn it, Alex. Someone had put up pictures. Half a dozen black and white photographs were taped to the wall of the closet. It wasn't a killer's shrine. It was meant to be found. There were pictures of Nana, Damon, Janny, me, and Christine. Christine almost seemed to be smiling at the camera, that incredible smile of hers, those big, welcoming eyes. The pictures had been taken in Bermuda. Whoever had rented this apartment had taken them. Finally, I had something to link Christine's abduction to the murders in Washington. I knew who had taken her. Back off, before you lose everything. I sensed fear again. It was my own. Chapter 64. Patsy Hampton had decided that she wasn't ready to confide in Chief George Pittman just yet. She didn't want the jefe interfering or crowding her. Also, she flat-out didn't trust or like the bastard. She still hadn't made up her mind what to do about Alex Cross. Cross was a complication. The more she checked him out, the better he looked. He seemed to be a very good, dedicated detective, and she felt bad about keeping Chuck Hufstedler's information away from him. Chuck had been Cross's source first, but she'd used the techie's crush on her to gain an advantage. She didn't like herself for doing that. She drove her Jeep to the British Embassy late that afternoon. She had Jeffrey Schaefer under limited surveillance. Hers. She could get more teams, but that would mean going to Pittman now, and she didn't want anyone to know what she had. She didn't want to be crowded. She had done her preliminary homework on Schaefer. He was in the security service, which meant he was British intelligence operating outside England. Most likely he was a spy working out of the embassy on Massachusetts Avenue. His reputation was okay. Good, actually. His current assignment supposedly had to do with the British government's human rights program, which meant the assignment was bullshit. He lived in Kalorama, a high-rent district, one he couldn't afford on his salary. So who the hell was this Schaefer chap? Hampton sat parked in her vehicle outside the embassy on California Street. She smoked a Marlboro Light and started to think things through. She really ought to talk to Cross about where he was with his investigation. Did he know anything that could help? Maybe he was onto Schaefer, too. It was almost criminal for her not to contact Cross and share what she'd gotten from Chuck E. Cheese. Pittman's dislike for Cross was well known. He considered him competition. She didn't know Cross that well, but he got too many headlines. Still, she wished she knew what Cross had in his files, and especially whether Jeffrey Schaefer had appeared on Cross's radar. There was too much fricking noise in the fricking street near the British Embassy. Workers were doing construction on the Turkish Chancery across California Street. Hampton already had a headache. Her life was one big headache, and she wished they would stop pounding and hammering and battering and sawing. For some reason or other, there was a crowd of people swarming all over the National Mosque today. At a few minutes past five, Schaefer got into his Jaguar in a parking lot outside the glass-walled rotunda. She'd seen him twice before. He was in very good shape and attractive, too, though not a physical type she herself responded to. Schaefer sure didn't hang around long after the workday ended. Hampton figured he either had some place to go or really hated his day job. Possibly both. She stayed a safe distance behind the black jag, following it along crowded Massachusetts Avenue. Schaefer didn't seem to be heading home, and he wasn't going to Southeast either. Where are we going tonight, she wondered as she tailed him. And what does it have to do with the Four Horsemen? What game are you really playing? What are your fantasies? Are you a bad man? A murderer, Jeffrey? You don't look like it, Blondie. Such a nice, spiffy car for a scumbag killer. Chapter 65. After work, Jeffrey Schaefer joined the clogged artery of rush hour traffic inching along Massachusetts. Turning out of the embassy, he had spotted the black Jeep behind him. The tail was still there as he drove down Massachusetts Avenue. Who's in the Jeep? One of the other players? D.C. Police? Detective Alex Cross? They've found the garage in Eckington. Now they've found me. It has to be the bloody police. He watched the black Jeep as it trailed four cars behind him. There was only one person inside, and it looked like a woman. Could it possibly be Lucy? Had she discovered the truth about him? God, had she finally figured out who and what he was? He picked up his mobile phone and made a call home. Lucy picked up after a couple of rings.
Darling, I'm coming home after all. There's a bit of a lull at the office. We can order in or something. Unless you and the children already have plans.
She blathered on in her usual maddening way. She and the twins had been going to catch a movie, Ants, but they'd rather stay home with him. They could order from Pizza Hut. It would be fun for a change.
Yes, what fun, Schaefer said.
and cringed at the thought. Pizza Hut served indigestible cardboard drenched with very bad tomato soup. He hung up, then took a couple of Vicodin and a Xanax. He thought he could feel cracks slowly opening up in his skull. He made a dangerous U-turn on Massachusetts Avenue and headed toward home. He passed the Jeep going in the opposite direction and was tempted to wave. A woman driver. Now who was she? The pizza got to the house at around 7, and Schaefer opened an expensive bottle of Cabernet. He washed down another Xanax with the wine in the downstairs bathroom. Felt a little confused, fuzzy around the edges. That was all right, he supposed. Jesus Christ, he couldn't stand being with his family, though. He felt as if he were going to crawl out of his skin. Ever since he was a boy in England, he'd had a repetitive fantasy that he was actually a reptile and could shed his own skin. He'd had the dream long before he read any Kafka. He still had the disturbing dream. He rolled 3 dice in his hand as he sipped his wine, played the game at the dinner table. If the number 17 came up, he would murder them all tonight. He swore he would do it. First the twins, then Robert, and then Lucy. She kept prattling on and on about her day. He smiled blithely as she told him about her shopping trip to Bloomingdale's and Bath and Body Works and Bruno Cipriani at the mall. He considered the supreme irony of his taking truckloads of antidepressants and only becoming more depressed. Jesus, he was cycling down again. How low could he go?
"Come 17," he finally said aloud.
"What, darling?" Lucy suddenly asked. "Did you just say something?"
"He's already playing tonight's game," said Robert, and snickered. "Right, Daddy? It's your fantasy game. Am I right?"
"Right, son," Schaefer replied, thinking, "Christ, I am mad."
He let the dice gently fall on the dining table, though. He would kill them if their number came up. The dice rolled over and over, then banked off the greasy pizza box.
"Daddy and his games," Lucy said, and laughed.
Erica and Tricia laughed. Robert laughed.
6, 5, 1, he counted. "Damn. Damn."
"Are the two of us going to play tonight?" Robert asked.
Schaefer forced a smile.
"Not tonight, Rob boy. I'd like to, but I can't. I have to go out again."
Chapter 66. This was getting very interesting. Patsy Hampton watched Schaefer leave the large and expensive house in Kalorama at around 8:30. He was off on another of his nightly jaunts. The guy was a regular vampire. She knew that Cross and his friends called the killer the Weasel, and it certainly fit Schaefer. There was something uncomfortable about him, something bent. She followed the black jag, but he didn't head toward Southeast, which disappointed her. He drove to a trendy supermarket, Sutton on the Run, just off DuPont Circle. Hampton knew the pricey store and called it Why Pay Less. He parked the sports car illegally, then jogged inside. Diplomatic immunity. That pissed her the hell off. What a weasel he was. Real Euro trash. While he was in the market, Hampton made a command decision. She was pretty sure she was going to talk to Alex Cross. She had thought a lot about it, the pros and cons. Now she figured that she might be endangering lives in Southeast by not sharing at least some of what she knew. If someone died, she wouldn't be able to bear it. Besides, Cross would have gotten the information if she hadn't interceded with Chuck Hufstedler. Schaefer shuffled back out of Sutton on the Run and glanced around crowded DuPont Circle. He had a small bag of overpriced groceries clutched in one arm. Groceries for whom, though? He didn't look in the direction of her Jeep, which was just peeking around the corner. She followed the black jag at a safe distance in the light traffic. He got onto Connecticut Avenue. She didn't think he'd spotted her, though he was an MI6 man, so she needed to be careful. Schaefer wasn't far from Embassy Row. He wouldn't be going back to work now, would he? Why the groceries if he was headed to the embassy? The Jaguar eventually turned into the underground garage of a pre-war building in Woodley Park. The Farragut was engraved on a brass sign in front. Patsy Hampton waited a few minutes, then pulled into the garage behind the Jag. She needed to look around, check things out if she could. The garage was public-private, so it wasn't any big deal. She walked over to the attendant in the small kiosk and identified herself.
"The Jag that came in before me, ever see it here before?" she asked.
The man nodded. He was around her age, and she could tell he wanted to impress her if he could.
"Sure. I don't know him to talk to, though. Comes here to visit a lady on 10. Dr. Elizabeth Cassidy. She's a shrink. I assume he's a patient. He's got a funny look in his eyes," the attendant said. "But so do most people."
"How about me?" Hampton asked.
"Nah. Well, maybe a little," the attendant said, and grinned.
Schaefer stayed upstairs with Dr. Cassidy for nearly 2 hours. Then he came down and went straight back to the house in Kalorama. Patsy Hampton followed him, then watched the house for another half hour. She thought that Schaefer was probably in for the night. She drove to a nearby diner, but didn't go inside right away. She picked up her mobile phone before she had too many second thoughts. She knew Cross's street and got the phone number through information. Was it too late to call? Screw it, she was going through with this. She was surprised when the phone was picked up on the first ring. She heard a pleasant male voice, nice, strong. "Hello? Alex Cross." She almost hung up on him. Interesting that he'd intimidated her for a moment.
"This is Detective Patsy Hampton. I've been doing some work on the Jane Does. I've been following a man who is a suspect. I think we should talk."
"Where are you, Patsy?" Cross said without hesitation. "I'll come to you. Just tell me where."
"I'm at the City Limits Diner on Connecticut Avenue."
"I'm on my way," said Cross.
Chapter 67.
I wasn't totally surprised that Pittman had assigned someone to the Jane Does, especially after Zach Taylor's article in the Washington Post. I was interested in any leads Detective Hampton might have turned up. I had seen Patsy Hampton around, and she obviously knew who I was. She was supposed to be on a fast track. She was a smart and effective senior homicide detective, though from what I'd heard, she was also a lone wolf. She didn't have any friends in the department, as far as I knew. She was much prettier than I remembered. She was in very trim, athletic shape, probably early 30s, short blonde hair, piercing blue eyes that cut through the diner haze. She'd put on bright red lipstick for our meeting, or maybe she wore it all the time. I wondered what was on her mind and what her motives were. I didn't think I could trust her.
"You or me first?" Detective Hampton asked, after we'd ordered coffee.
We were seated at a table in the City Limits Diner, near a window looking out on Connecticut Avenue. "I'm afraid I don't know what this is about," I told her. She sipped her coffee and gave me a look over the cup's rim. She was a strong-willed, confident person. Her eyes told me that much.
"You really don't know someone else was working on the Jane Does?"
I shook my head. "Pittman said that the cases were closed. I took him at his word. He suspended some good detectives for working the cases after hours."
"There's a lot of seriously nasty crap going on in the department. So what's new, though?" she said, as she set down her cup.
She gave a deep sigh.
"I thought I could deal with it by myself. Now I'm not so sure."
"Pittman assigned you to the Jane Does, personally?" She nodded, then her blue eyes narrowed.
"He assigned me to the Glover and Cardinal murders and any others I wanted to look into. Gave me free rein."
"And you say you have something?"
"Maybe. I've got a possible suspect. He's involved in a role-playing game that features victims being murdered, mostly in Southeast. It's all after-the-fact stuff, so he could have read the news stories and then fantasized about them. He works at the British Embassy."
This was a new piece of information, and it surprised me. "How far have you gone with this?"
"Not to Pittman, if that's what you mean. I've done a little discreet checking on the suspect. Trouble is, he seems to be a solid citizen. Very good at his job, supposedly. At least, that's the official word from the embassy.
Nice family in Kalorama. I've been watching Schaefer a little, hoping I'd get lucky. His first name is Jeffrey. I knew that she was supposed to be a little bit of a loose cannon, and that she didn't suffer fools gladly. "You're out here alone tonight?" I asked her. Hampton shrugged.
"That's how I usually operate. Partners slow me down. Chief Pittman knows how I like to work. He gave me the green light. All green, all day long."
I knew she was waiting for me to give her something, if I had anything. I decided to play along. "We found a cab that the killer apparently used in Southeast. He kept it in a garage in Eckington."
"Anybody see the suspect in the neighborhood?"
She asked the right question first. "The landlady saw him. I'd like to show her pictures of your guy. Or do you want to do it yourself?" Her face was impassive.
"I'll do it. First thing in the morning. Anything revealing in the apartment?"
I wanted to be straight with her. She'd initiated the meeting, after all. "Photographs of me and my family covered a wall in a closet. They were taken of us in Bermuda, while we were on vacation. He was there, watching us all the time." Hampton's face softened.
"I heard your fiancé disappeared in Bermuda. Word gets around."
"There were photographs of Christine, too," I said. Her blue eyes became sad. I got a quick look behind her tough facade.
"I'm really sorry about your loss."
"I haven't given up yet," I told her. "Listen, I don't want any credit for solving these cases. Just let me help. He called me at home last night. Somebody did. Told me to back off. I assume that he meant this investigation, but I'm not supposed to be on it. If Pittman hears about us..." Detective Hampton interrupted me.
"Let me think about everything you've said. You know that Pittman will totally crucify me if he finds out. You have no idea. Trouble is, I don't trust him."
This book is continued on Disc 6.